yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. This is Bob Frelick. And
I'm Julia Minton.
And we're here to give you an hour of clear thinking and some ideas on how to do that. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And actually, this is our 13th show, so it's our one-year birthday of Thinking Clearly.
That's
and we're
right.
Sitting here in front of a fine piece of chocolate cake. It's about, like, what would you call that, 3 inches by 3 inches here?
It looks about three layers. It's kind of like a tiered wedding cake that could feed at least 150.
Oh, what an imagination. Okay, well, we're going to get on with the show today, and let's tell you a little bit about our topic here tonight. By the way, you can get our previous shows. They're archived for like a couple months, maybe 3 months on KMUD.org, and you'll see the archive button on the upper right-hand position on our webpage, KMUD.org. We've talked about the definition, a working definition. We're working on a working definition on the show of critical thinking. Critical thinking is one of those things that it is not precisely defined. It's in the eye of the beholder, sort of. I've run across
although it means something.
It does mean something. And so we've been trying to massage a working definition that adds detail to what critical thinking is. And our definition, and I'm going to kind of read our definition, but it's I'll tell you that it's kind of got 3 points to it. And the first point is that we're talking about forming claims or conclusions, and claims are simple statements that we say are true. And if we use a bunch of claims to logically connect to another kind of claim, which is our conclusion, that's the first part of critical thinking. So you do need to learn
like this
logic.
This is a chocolate cake. It can feed at least 150 people. Therefore, if I eat all of it, I will be very sick.
Well, we'll have to tackle that argument. We'll have some call-ins about that argument and see how it flies.
But those were premises.
Those were claims.
Chocolate.
Yes.
It can feed 150 people. Therefore, if I eat all of it, I will be sick.
Yes. And we've talked about the difference between deductive and inductive logic. We're not going to get into that too much tonight. We'll do that on a whole other show.
But logic is one aspect of critical thinking. So
yes.
You've kind of outlined them in sort of like 3 bullet points. In our second.
The second? Go ahead. What's the second?
Oh, okay. The second would be to understand and attempt to compensate for our cognitive vulnerabilities. In other words, I am a human with a brain and a body, and everything I perceive and understand isn't perfect. So I have to take those things into account.
Yeah, and we've talked about some of those, including cognitive biases, confirmation bias being the big one. We've talked about heuristics, and an example of a heuristic is called availability. Availability is kind of a shortcut to coming up with a conclusion about something in what we call our fast thinking or our system one. Our more intuitive processes uses that form of reasoning. And an example would be that because we see so many different examples of accidents, we hear about them on the radio, we see them on TV, we read them in the newspaper, the first thing that comes to our mind with a lot of people when they think about causes of death. Less apt to think about strokes. But in reality, strokes actually account for about twice as many deaths as accidents do.
Well, I've seen a lot of accidents, but I've never seen anyone have a stroke.
Exactly. So that availability is a quick shortcut method of coming up with a conclusion, an answer to something. And it's sometimes wrong. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's quick, and it gives us the spot-on answer and the right answer, the right decision. And sometimes it's very, very wrong.
But evolutionarily, it's probably served us more than not.
That's true. But we're in a unique evolutionary period where the complexity now of life in modern days mm-hmm. is so much more complex. Mm-hmm. The kinds of problems that we're dealing with, the kinds of decisions that we need to make are very, very different than they were in prehistoric times. And so that's the second part of the definition, is to gain some awareness of these cognitive vulnerabilities that we have so we can mitigate for them, so we can take them into consideration and learn to spot when we need to check out our fast thinking, to check it out with some reason, with some evidence, some logic, and especially those decisions that are important.
Mm-hmm. Like a really simple example is, I happen to know I'm incredibly bad at estimating distances. Mm-hmm. I'll look at something and I go, oh, that's 50 feet away. Well, it's probably more like 15. So I've learned that is a habitual problem of mine that I haven't yet corrected. So I know basically not to trust myself and to get mm-hmm. out the measuring tape.
Especially if it's important.
Measure twice, cut once.
Exactly. Well, the third part of our definition has to do with a willingness to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions. So just like we check out our intuition and we use a check to see if that's accurate in many cases when we can, we also have an awareness that we may be wrong and a willingness to consider that our beliefs need to be updated mm-hmm. and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs. So that's the three prongs of our definition, our present working definition mm-hmm. of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, speak for yourself. I do not recall being wrong ever.
Okay. Not even that time, right?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, no, you're so good about that. You are so good about, She's being facetious. She is very good about examining beliefs in light of evidence. I've seen that happen time and again.
Don't let the people in on it.
Well, our topic tonight is going to be just that issue, clinging to beliefs. Some examples of beliefs. Why do we cling to beliefs? And some examples of beliefs that we commonly think are true and turn out to be false, including some urban legends, myths, and hoaxes. So it's kind of a fun show tonight. And as always, I get immersed in the research. I try to wrap my head around it, and it begins to wrap around my head. And I do this with every topic, going in thinking this will be easy. I'll just put this and this and this together, and I find out how rich and robust all these topics are. Mm-hmm. People have spent years and years, many life hours have gone into examining these topics in detail, mm-hmm. all the nuances. So I constantly am gaining appreciation for all the topics that we've talked about. And this is no exception. But before we get into that, I do want to bring this up because it's a bit of irony here. Did you ever see the movie The Big Short?
I did.
Did you?
Yeah, it's about like Wall Street and stuff.
Exactly, the mortgage crisis and that sort of thing. Do you remember that opening scene? Where I think, if I remember it, it's somebody walking and you're seeing their back and they're carrying a small child on their shoulder, something like that, a field. I kind of vaguely remember it. But up on the screen pops this quote, and the quote reads, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." And after that quote pops up Mark Twain, mm-hmm. right? Well, I really love that quote because it summarizes the topic tonight. But the ironic thing is that the filmmakers got it wrong. There's no evidence that quote actually came from Mark Twain. It doesn't appear in any of his books or essays or letters or speeches.
Well, he should have said it.
I know, because it's got double ain'ts in it.
Yeah.
It's, sounds like it's
convinced
something.
Convinced me.
I know. It sounds like it. It's something that Mark Twain would say. But there's no evidence that he did say it. And the closest he came to that is he said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. And according to the website, for checking out quotes like that, which is quoteinvestigator.com, the quote probably came from a man who lived from 1818 to 1885, whose pen name was Josh Billings, and he was a humorist. And his real name was Henry Wheeler. So anyway, tonight we're going to briefly get into some thoughts about why people hold beliefs. And often, even when confronted with evidence to the contrary, they hang on to those beliefs. Oh, in related news, 2016 Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year, post-truth. It's an adjective. They defined it as, quote, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief.
And we live in a postmodern hell. That's all I have to say.
I know. But that's why we're doing this show. One reason why we're doing this show. We have fun, and that's another reason. And we get yearly a piece of chocolate, this fine chocolate cake that's in front of us with a one candle on it. But at any rate, there's been books that are called Post-Truth Era by Ralph Keyes. That came out in 2004. And of course, Stephen Colbert popularized the word truthiness. We heard a clip from Colbert on one of the shows, previous shows. So anyway, that's what we're talking about tonight.
May I add another quote as well?
Yes.
From my main man, Bertrand Russell.
All right.
Big fan of the Bert.
Uh-huh.
He said, the universe is what it is, not what I choose it to be.
Oh, yes.
Just a little something.
I can see you shudder.
Just a little something for that postmodern, you know.
Oh, Big Bert. Yeah, he said he had a lot of good quotes.
He wasn't always right like me.
No, he probably wasn't. but he knew when he wasn't right. All right. Well, you know, we like to start out with definitions on this show, and there's a reason for that. It's not just because we like to look things up and define them. Have you ever had a discussion with someone and spent minutes and minutes and minutes discussing and maybe disagreeing, and then found out that what was wrong with the discussion is you hadn't defined what your terms were.
Yes.
And when each of you defined your terms and agreed upon a definition, the differences might have disappeared or minimized. Yes.
I recently had a conversation with someone about vegetarianism, and apparently they believe that pescatarianism.
What is it?
Was pescatarianism is the same thing as vegetarianism.
Awful.
It's where you eat fish.
Ooh, okay.
But fish isn't vegetarian. So once we got down to that they believed eating fish was part of vegetarianism, and I said it wasn't. Once we figured that out, and they were talking about pescatarianism, and I was talking about vegetarianism, we realized we were having two different conversations.
Yes. It happens. It's happened a lot to me. So it's always great when you get in discussions to define the key terms. You know, just stop and say, well, what? I'm curious. What do you mean by that? Whatever it is.
Because a lot of the times we just assume that we're both using the same word, so we must assume it means the same thing.
Right. So I did look up the various definitions of the term belief, which is our key term for tonight. And I chose there's three definitions in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And I thought it was interesting because the first definition is, quote, a state or habit of mind in which trust or confidence is placed in some person or thing. Can you read the second one?
Something that is accepted, considered to be true, or held as an opinion.
And the third is conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on the examination of evidence.
Well, those are some different definitions.
They're quite different. The first two definitions Say anything about evidence.
And contrasting trust and confidence with evidence is like not even the same ballpark. I'm not sure it's the same sport.
Right. But I think it does encompass the variety of definitions that's used in that term belief. Belief is a complex term, and it can be defined quite differently. So tonight, because this is a show about critical thinking, of course, we're going to go with definition number three. We're going to be talking about beliefs as beliefs are tied to evidence.
And number three is the conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination of evidence.
Yes. There's been so much research, and more all the time because of we're living in this post-truth era, about beliefs, about how we come to our beliefs, how we hang on to our beliefs, how we tend to confirm our beliefs, how we share our beliefs with a group that we identify with. There's so much work in cognitive psychology, neuroscience, sociology, and other fields, especially important in the media. Many fields examine this idea of belief. For example, a recent research published in the peer-reviewed journal Political Psychology. By the way, that's another thing is that if people are making claims or talking about something, it's good for those people and it's good for you to expect them to actually quote their sources so that you can go look that up. Mm-hmm. So you could actually, when I give you the name of the researcher, look this up on Google or search for Political Psychology, the journal. And this was by Dartmouth professor Brendan Nyhan and others. And they were studying people's political misinformation and its implication for political democracy. And they concluded the following. This was in the conclusion part of their paper. Of course, when you look up a piece of research that's published in a journal, scholarly journal, generally it starts out with an abstract which summarizes the reason for the research and why they were embarking on the research in the first place, a real quick summary of background and a conclusion, a summary of their conclusion. So it gives you an idea. Do you really want to read that paper? Is that something that you're going to be interested in? And then you can go to the conclusion and read the conclusions. That's a good starting point for mm-hmm. analyzing or trying to really go to an original source in a journal.
Gives you that 30,000 foot view, as they say.
Right. And they conclude this, quote, if the conclusions reached so far are correct, the threat of misperceptions to democracy cannot be avoided, especially in the highly polarized world of contemporary American politics. Facts are always at least potentially vulnerable to directional motivated reasoning, especially when they are politicized by elites. The polarization that our politics must confront is thus not just over issues and public policy, but over reality itself. I thought that was a pretty heavy statement.
That's a very heavy statement.
It is.
And that's what happens when you combine politics and psychology.
It's dramatic, but it did strike me because one of the things that we will eventually talk about is worldviews. And worldviews have to do with how we, our overarching idea of what reality really
mm-hmm.
is.
And, just like at climate change.
Exactly. And we tend, it's you, if you really want to get in trouble, try and attack somebody's worldview. they will defend that.
I have to say, though, that last sentence, it gives me chills.
Yeah, I know.
The polarization that our politics must confront is thus not just over issues and public policy, but over reality itself.
Yeah. And, So it's worth reading that paper. So you can if you want to search for that paper. And by the way, I'll post this on our Facebook page too, a link to the paper. So Brendan Nyhan, it's Nyhan, and the title of the paper is the journal is Political Psychology. Let's take a listen to a clip. I have a clip from Brendan Nyhan, and it was taken from the it's actually called the Truthiness Conference at Harvard University, and that was back in March of 2012. So let's listen to this clip from Brendan Nyhan.
it's very threatening to be told that you're wrong. There's a cognitive element to this and a political element to this, but there's also a self-image or self-concept aspect to this that my co-author Jason Reifler and I have explored in our research. But I just want to underscore how threatening it can be to be told that you're wrong about something, and that the defensive reactions that threat can generate are part of what make correcting misperception so difficult. What I want to do is think about what are different approaches to trying to correct misperceptions, okay? And the obvious place to start, and a place that I have myself called for in my writing, is for the media to be more aggressive in trying to fact-check misperceptions. This is a conference about truthiness in online media, but the mainstream media is still a very potent source of information, very important in the political culture of this country, right? So what if the media were more aggressive in trying to counter misinformation? This is an example, the death panel story in 2009. The press was more aggressive in fact-checking that claim than, say, they were in the run-up to the Iraq War. So is that likely to be effective? And what my co-author and I did was we actually looked at this experimentally. Okay, we took undergraduates, right, and we gave them mock news articles where we could experimentally manipulate whether or not they saw the corrective information. So we have precise control of what they're seeing, and we can measure exactly what their reaction is to it. The question is, what happens when we give them this corrective information? Is this effective at getting them to change their minds about the given factual belief? And the answer is generally no. Okay, so the pattern across the studies we've conducted is that there's frequently a resistance to corrections on the part of the group that's most likely to want to disbelieve that correction. This is something we call disconfirmation bias, and it's very consistent with the story that Chris described to you a moment ago. This is a claim that was made by John Kerry and John Edwards in 2004. They made statements suggesting that President Bush had banned all stem cell research in this country. That is not true. He limited federal funding to pre-existing stem cell lines. But the language that was used implied that there was a complete ban on stem cell research. So we exposed subjects to a mock news article about this claim and gave them a correction. Well, who's likely to want to believe this claim? Liberals who don't like President Bush. And what you'll see is that our correction was not effective at reducing their reported levels of misperceptions. Conservatives were quite happy to hear that President Bush hadn't done this and to go along with it. Liberals, on the other hand, didn't move. So the correction isn't working. So while that might be troubling enough, it gets worse. Okay? In some cases, corrections don't just fail to change people's minds, they make the misperceptions worse. Okay? And this is what we call the backfire effect. We document two of these in our article, which I'd encourage you to read. Here we're talking about the claim that President Bush's tax cuts increased government revenue, a claim that even his own economists disagree with. Virtually no expert support for this claim. Again, liberals perfectly happy to go along with a correction of that statement. Conservatives double down, becoming vastly more likely to say that President Bush's tax cut increased revenue rather than less. So in our efforts to combat misinformation, if we're not careful, we can actually make the problem worse. And this is something that everyone should think about in this room when they're thinking about how to address misinformation. The Hippocratic Oath of misinformation, try not to do harm, because you can.
And we'll be talking about some examples of myths that turned out not to be true, some of them very benign and some of them potentially very harmful. Nyan is one of the original researchers who coined that term backfire and did the original research on it too. Hope to have him maybe as a guest sometime on our show. Well, we don't want to get any more into the details of the research because that can take hours and hours and be difficult to do in the limited time that we have. And we want to have a little fun with this tonight. So we're going to talk about some things that maybe we believed and then found out not to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start off, and then I know you brought something. I don't know what it is, so it's going to be a surprise to me. I'm going to start off with a pretty benign one. It's a common belief that water draining from a sink or a toilet rotates in the vortex there, rotates in one direction in the northern hemisphere, and the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere.
I've seen it. It's true.
I checked it out, to see.
Did you go to Australia?
I didn't go to Australia.
Well, then you don't know.
Well, there is a guy, actually, who makes his living by having a little portable sink And he is in an area where he straddles the equator. And when he's on one side of the equator, it goes one direction. He steps on the other side, it goes the other direction. Okay? The only thing wrong with that is that it's not true. It's completely false.
I thought I had some weird hobbies.
People have explained this by the Coriolis effect. Okay, the Coriolis effect is a true effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's caused by the rotation of the Earth, and the Coriolis effect does affect hurricanes. The direction of hurricanes.
It's like an atmospheric thing, right?
It will affect large masses, but they have to be large masses. It won't affect small things like your drains. Your drains, the way your drains swirl in your sink or your toilet have more to do with the way that bowl is manufactured than it does anything else.
Okay, so truth be known, I was in Australia, not this weekend, but, you know, many years ago. And it didn't swirl one way or another because, like you said, their toilets are totally different. They just go swoosh and everything just goes out.
Yeah.
But
you could have tested it in a sink. For example, filled a sink up and, you know, or a tub, a bathtub, and then put a little matchstick in there to see which way the vortex was going. But what you'll find is that if there is consistency, it's because the bowls are all manufactured sort of the same way. So the Coriolis effect will affect large things like hurricanes, the direction that hurricanes rotate. But long range ballistic missiles, they have to take the Coriolis effect into account.
And the ocean too, maybe a little.
Well, I didn't actually. Someone else asked me about that, and I didn't actually check that, so I'm not going to venture an opinion on that. But the little nuance here is that a researcher did try to, a legitimate researcher, not the guy that was on the equator, did try to see if he could substantiate whether the Coriolis effect did have an effect on a vortex of water in a vessel. And he did find some consistency, but he had to use 300 gallons of water because the Coriolis effect is such a small effect that it has to act on a big mass, and it takes time for it to actually manifest.
Mm.
So, it reminded me of these myths and these hoaxes, these urban legends, conspiracy theories. They all have a seed of truth to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a little part of them that kind of draws us in, and we think, that makes sense, that rings true. But when you begin to look at the nuances, you know, the argument usually falls apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, I remember very clearly when I was a young kid, my father describing the Coriolis effect to me, and he had some sort of story about somebody winning a bet at a pool table because they could spin the ball the right way. And it totally made sense to me when I was 9. So I believed it to be true. And I'll tell you, when we were talking about this, the reality of the Coriolis effect.
Yes, this came up at a conversation with you and I and Eric Kirk.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was in total disbelief for like at least 20 minutes. I was open to the idea that that might be true, but for, 20 years in my brain, I had a certain understanding that that was the way things were. And it's really hard to wrap your brain around reprocessing something you thought was true and right for so long.
Sure. Yeah. You have an example.
I do. I did bring an example. For anybody who's ever suffered from a urinary tract infection, they're terrible. They're awfully painful, and it can lead to, desperations for cures. I can tell you that much. And one of the most common recommendations for home remedy or subsiding symptoms of urinary tract infections is drinking cranberry juice.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure you've heard that. Or taking cranberry pill supplements.
You're not going to tell me this is wrong now, right?
Well, Dr. Manisha Jantani Mehta, I hope I got that name right, said, I was hoping it would work. She's a infectious disease specialist at Yale School of Medicine and the lead author of a study published Thursday in the journal JAMA, which showed no reduction in urinary tract infections for female nursing home patients who took standardized high-dose cranberry capsules, the equivalent of drinking 20 ounces of juice daily for a year. The doctor said, I'm not sure it's worth spending money on, particularly for patients on a fixed income.
Oh, goodness. So that's the same sort of thing, is that there is an effect there, but it takes a huge amount of the cure to actually have any real effect on the urinary tract.
That's right. And I would say this is also one of those things that can be both benign or harmful, because it depends. If you are choosing to do cranberry supplements instead of taking antibiotics, you can suffer permanent damage. In fact, you can have kidney infections. You can go into septic shock.
Yeah. I would venture to say that, did you finish?
Well, I was going to say, however, it could be benign, because one thing that that is very, very helpful with urinary tract infections is drinking any kind of fluid. So anything that gets you drinking more fluid is beneficial.
Okay, great. Yeah, I would go so far as to say any kind of belief, even the one about the toilet or sink water swirling in different directions, has some negative effect, because if we don't update our beliefs when the new evidence comes in, or take the time to check out a belief even that we've thought for years was true, then we get in the habit of not being critical thinkers and accepting beliefs and not checking them out.
And in particular, this doctor is trying to move the medical industry, who is continuing to recommend cranberry supplements.
Oh,
and she simply says in this interview, it's time to move on from cranberries.
Okay. Sounds like something that Dr. Stephen Novella would be interested in science-based medicine. Well, we have other things to say, but I think something we said prompted some phone calls. And so the topic tonight is beliefs. So we're hoping that you're going to add some value to the topic and talk about beliefs that you thought that you were true and found out that weren't, things that other people found out that were true, or how you come about your beliefs. Something related to beliefs is the topic tonight. So, hello, caller.
Hello, caller.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
My question is not in regards to what you were just asking, but I wanted to go back to that Bertrand Russell quote.
Oh, yeah.
Could you repeat that, please?
Oh, let's see. You have to give me a minute. It was, goodness.
She'll get it for you. Is that something that you want to write down?
As I recall, it has something to do with him observing the universe, and whether or not he thought a certain way, it would still go on. Paraphrasing.
Here it is, yes. The universe is what it is, not what I choose that it should be. And he was a philosopher from the early 1900s, and I believe that was sort of around the era in which there was a flourishing of postmodern philosophy, and a little bit of a tug and pull with existentialism and kind of materialism, if you will.
Okay. Well, my question is this: by that phrase, so therefore, from what I'm understanding of that phrase, Bertrand Russell did not include himself in the universe?
No, I wouldn't infer that myself. I think.
I would say, knowing Bertrand Russell's works, that he certainly would have included himself in the universe, because he wouldn't have assumed that he somehow is apart from the universe.
Right. I think it's more about it's a comment on objective reality. I think I would say that at the time, without getting too thick into philosophy, existentialism was really kind of saying essence precedes existence, that we can kind of define our own meaning, which, you know, might be true in a sort of, you know, the way you live your life. But there's still a universe out there, and gravity exists whether you believe it should or not.
Yeah, but go ahead, caller. Where were you going with that?
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
All right.
Thank you, caller. We have
you have another caller, and you're on the line. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi.
Hi.
You start talking about the Coriolis effect, and that sort of is a subject that used to interest me a lot. And but I don't know if you really want to talk about that stuff too much. I got interested in that because I took a fluids engineering class, and when the professor, I think it was the first day, he talked about how a fluid, when it's traveling down a pipe, for example, it accelerates, it's going faster, it'll become turbulent, and it'll churn around,
yes.
Which is not at all intuitive. And, of course, that and that's a horizontal pipe, and, of course, when you have fluids moving up and down, they tend to spin. And at the time, the professor, what really caught my attention, is said, we don't know why it becomes turbulent. And that was a while ago. That was like, 30 years ago, 20 mm-hmm. years ago, something like that. So I don't want to, I could talk about that for a while. That's probably not what you want to talk about.
But it is fascinating.
But it is interesting. And wasn't it Bernoulli that, did some of the mathematics on that?
Well, what my professor said, what occurred to me, if you look at the math, there's an equation. There's an equation for deriving what they call the Reynolds number, mm-hmm. and basically, when the Reynolds number for say a pipe, for example, goes above a certain number, you get turbulence, and the fluid starts churning, and he said, see, now I'm losing my thought, train of thought, but.
Your thoughts are becoming chaotic.
Yeah, no. Anyway, now I'm losing my train of thought. Maybe it'll come back to me. But what I was thinking is the nice thing about science is you approach something with sort of an open mind. You have mm-hmm. a hypothesis, and you say, well, maybe it's caused by this. Mm-hmm. And then you crunch the numbers. And what my professor said, he says, well, the numbers don't work out. When we try and show that these things are being caused by Coriolis, it just doesn't balance. The numbers aren't working for us.
Yeah.
And but there's other things going on. You have like gravitational fields, and as if a charged particle like the cyclotron, you have a magnet, and you got other things going on besides just Coriolis. You also have gravitational fields and things like
that. Sure,
that take place. But what's nice about science is you have like a hypothesis, and then you're not tied to it by religion, where you're entitled, you're required to believe a certain outcome. You can modify your hypothesis if the numbers don't work out. You say, well, maybe there's some other thing involved. And so that's what's really nice about science.
The scientific method, and along with that is that it's a very democratic and universal method. Because science works the same no matter whether you're in the United States or you're in Iran.
Yeah.
And everyone has equal access to information from science and to learning about science. So that's another thing that is a positive for science.
Yeah. One thing that really disturbs me a lot is that the whole emphasis, unfortunately, in education is really about just creating worker bees for the investor class.
Yeah.
And so instead of everyone coming out of high school with an understanding of a subject like chemistry, which is important for cooking and painting and working on your car and everything in your life, everyone's so totally alienated because basically the system is set up for people who read, write, and do arithmetic real quick that everybody else gets, just discouraged and doesn't learn it. And so instead of having a well-educated population that can put in a septic system, for example, that works, you have a population that needs a whole bunch of regulations to tell you what to do because nobody knows what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, I also definitely good points, caller. I'll also add that something that frustrates me is when I hear other people saying, you can't trust science. It says one thing one day and says another thing the next day, and it's always changing its mind. Well, it's not church. It's not religion. Science doesn't have a dogma. In fact, science changing, even if it's on a day-to-day basis, is a sign that it is open to new information and to being as accurate as possible. So I would just encourage people, when they, you know, hear that something they once understood, you know, like dinosaurs might have feathers, that doesn't that shouldn't lose your confidence in science. That should actually be gaining confidence in science, that it's improving its knowledge base.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to move on.
The whole educational system is just so screwed up. It's not oriented towards keeping an educated populace. It's about serving someone.
We do have the California Common Core, which is some hope there. Okay.
But we as people also need to value education, and we need to express that as a value that we want to see.
We need to weigh in on our opinions. And we're going to give another caller a chance to weigh in on their opinions. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Is that me?
It is.
Oh, okay. I just want to comment on that Coriolis effect, because I was taught slightly different for evidence on what you were saying about the toilet. For one thing, it was based on like a whirlpool rather than a toilet. I think somebody simplified it. But what we were taught is if you're walking in a snowstorm or a sandstorm, you tend to turn to the right. You can't walk straight. So you have to accommodate for that by stopping and going over to the left. Or you've seen the old Westerns where they go, we just ended up in a circle. And you ended up where they started from. And that's what we were given as evidence of the Coriolis.
They probably were using that more as a metaphor, something you could physically see.
If you walk on snow and you walk for a long distance and you look at it from above, you turn to the right.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they were saying the Coriolis effect is. And then some people say if you're on the southern hemisphere, you will curve to the left.
Well, that's caused by the spinning of the Earth, but the idea that the spinning of the Earth can actually affect a small amount of water in the toilet or sink,
I'm saying the toilet is an oversimplification of a larger tidal pool.
It's just that the Coriolis effect is there, but it's not enough to actually affect the water. And if you do want to check this out, you can look. Wikipedia has got a very well-documented article on that. Just do a wiki search for Coriolis effect is Coriolis.
I'm just saying that's the way we were taught.
I can see that sort of as
toilet. The toilet is, like you say, it's too small to actually represent nature.
Yeah, yeah. The same way as if you shot an IBM missile, we're looking at it from above, you'd see the same
effect.
It will
arc slightly to the right or whatever. So then the Coriolis effect is...
The Coriolis effect is real. Real, and it affects weather.
I just wanted to say one thing about you.
Okay.
You're talking about how science and everything. I wanted to read a quote here.
Okay.
It says, the whole of science is nothing more than a refinement of everyday thinking. Now, do you know who said that?
No, I don't.
Albert Einstein.
All right.
Oh, sure.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll take the next call, and thanks for calling. Okay, caller, it's you, and
Hi.
You're on the air. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Yes. I wanted to comment on the cranberry juice thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the beliefs that we got to watch out for is the appeal to authority logical fallacy. The article and that you quoted with the authority who
conducted an experiment.
Yeah, she did an experiment with cranberry extract, not cranberry juice.
Correct. Cranberry capsules. Extract.
Yeah, now we need to know that's not cranberry juice. And what you said was, cranberry juice can solve urinary tract infections.
Right.
You're comparing two different things.
Right.
You would have to compare cranberry juice to cranberry juice to say that it was not effective.
I understand that. So they actually address that in the study. They say that cranberry juice in its earliest forms, purest form was far more stringent than the version now sold commercially. So one problem with studies, say critics, has been compliance with that. In fact, it's simply hard to drink that much modern commercially available cranberry juice to obtain the astringent factors that they were going for, which is why they used the cranberry capsules to simulate 20 ounces of juice. So you bring up a good point, which is that cranberry juice and cranberry capsules are in fact different things and may mm-hmm. have different qualities. The reason they went with the capsules was because based on previous studies, again, this is sort of the body of knowledge around the study, was that the amount of cranberry juice needed to be consumed on a daily basis for a year by nursing home patients was not realistic, basically.
But caller, I would like to commend you on your critical thinking. We love it when callers come in and they appeal to authority and they talk about things that really are germane to critical thinking. So put us on your speed dial for the first Thursday mm-hmm. of every month, and thank you very much.
Well, can I say one more thing?
You can.
And that's, you were talking about science. And we have a problem in society now where society has become many people's religion. And because it has the label of science, it's automatically correct, and they just bow down to it as if it were their god.
Well, I don't think we're encouraging anyone to do that here.
No, I'm not saying you are, but listen to how people talk about it and see how prevalent it is in society. Once it gets that label of science, people tend to just worship it.
Yeah,
and like you had just said, science changes every day. That's right. Science proves itself wrong every day.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get people worshiping at the altar of science, you have a lot of problems.
We
thank you. I do love your show,
okay.
And I listen to it on the ride home and try and get to it more. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. We appreciate your call.
Thank you very much. And I think
take care.
I think we have a couple other callers. Caller, this is Thinking Clearly. So
someone called in and they wanted me to ask for them.
Okay.
If you could touch on techniques and strategies for countering misinformation.
There's a number of good websites that actually do that, and one of them is Snopes.com, SNOPES.com. Snopes, not mm-hmm. perfect, but Snopes is does I think a good, reliable job at debunking or checking out, I should say, fact-checking some of these urban legends and myths and beliefs.
And especially when you see things on the internet kind of go viral and you're not sure where it comes from.
Right.
Stuff like, razor blades and people's car seats and whatnot. That seems to make the rounds every couple of years.
Yeah.
Snopes is there and they're like, oh yeah, in 2004, this came up as an urban legend and here's where it's from.
Right. That's my first go-to is Snopes, SNOPES.com. Another is, of course, for fact-checking is factcheck.org. It's just www.factcheck.org. And then politifact.com for political mm-hmm. facts is good. Do you have any others, Tad?
I would just recommend if you're having a conversation with someone who you believe is working with based on misinformation or something like that, is to remain open-minded. Try and really listen hard and encourage mutual understanding, because in conversations we often mirror each other, and if you're coming across as you need to listen to me and I'm going to correct you while you're right, the other person is going to be doing the same.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a earnest, honest, calm exchange of ideas, respectful earnest exchange of ideas, and seeking to have mutual understanding, the chances of people being open-minded, changing their mind, or even simply considering new beliefs is much higher.
Yeah. And I find that what I do, and I have conversations, and then I'll have said something, and someone will say, I'm not so sure that's true. I go home. I am compelled to go home and research it. And then I get back to them saying, you were right, I'll email them. And, mm-hmm. you know, this has just gotten to be a habit.
We had an excellent little thing like that on a radio show many years ago, didn't we? Where a common belief we all had was challenged.
Yes, and I'll talk about that in just a second. We've got two callers, and we want to make sure they've been waiting on the line. So welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Oh, hey, I just wanted to share some information, and I'm going to be very honest. I don't know if it's scientific, if it's factual, if it's true.
Great.
But I thought I could share it anyway on the off chance it is, and it could make a difference. In the beginning of the show, you mentioned something about strokes and accidents and not seeing someone. I neither have seen someone have a stroke, but I read something a few years back. If someone's not acting right and something seems like not right with them, but yet they can't seem to communicate with you, mm-hmm. think of the first three letters of stroke, STR, and if that person cannot smile, talk, mm-hmm. or raise their arms, there's a possibility they could be having a stroke. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know if it's scientific, if it's true, but I thought I should just share that.
Thank you.
We'll check that out to see if that is. It sounds intuitive. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's good information. And it's just an example of how our listeners take a bit of information that we talk about and call in and say something that's important that could really affect somebody's life.
That's true. Thank you, caller.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think we have one more caller.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. And it's you.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I was just wondering about the critical thing. The most critical thing I can think about right now is whether we can continue on this path of war, you know, and still exist. And what? How do we get to war? Have to have hate to have war. How do you get to hate? Have to have lies. Where do the lies come from? Lies come from Lucifer. But anyway, so... So there's openness, truth, love, and peace, possibility. But, you know, we have to win over the hearts of these people who are mindlessly following the wishes of the devil. And, you know, I know you people probably believe in evolution. I got a real good question for you for evolution if you don't want to talk about this.
Well, we don't want to get into any particular beliefs. But we're getting close to the top of the hour. I have a few things left that we want to say. But let me just say that you left one thing out: secrecy.
Oh no, I was getting to that. Yeah, secrecy. Right, because that's how can you keep a secret without lying?
Yeah.
It's true.
Okay. Well, listen. We have just a few minutes left in the show, and we have a couple other things that we want to get into with beliefs. But thank you for calling. And now you were talking about.
So there was a great show that you and I and Eric Kirk did on All Things Reconsidered, mm-hmm. And. It was very interesting. We were talking about something that it was around the holidays.
Holiday season.
And we were talking about something that I feel is talked about every holiday season, which is the rising suicide rates and cause of depression around the mm-hmm. holidays.
Yes.
And I swear, I hear it every year. Because, of course, the holidays are very emotionally difficult on some of us. And a caller called in and said, well, actually, you know, statistically, suicide rates do not go up in the holidays.
Yes.
And Bob and I are looking at each other as our brains explode all over the walls. And we just kind of said, all right, well, we'll have to look into that. And Bob did some research.
Yes, I did. And the caller said, it gave me a little incentive and said, no, I used to work with some psychiatrists. And they told me that was not true, that suicide rates peak during the Christmas season. So I did some research because I had a number of suicide. I used to work on a suicide crisis hotline. And all the training I had years and years ago cited the Christmas holiday as a suicide peak. So we always used to double staff the holiday period on the crisis line. And what I found was that when I did the research, what I found was that, and this is from the Center for Disease Control, and along with the Annenberg Public Policy Center, which tracks media reports on suicides and that kind of thing for a number of years, is that actually the Christmas season is the low time for suicides. The peak periods are spring and fall. Mm. And that's an example of, so that's, you know, that's not true. That suicide peaks during the Christmas season. But, and that's kind of one of those that's a little bit, it's not completely benign because if you have limited resources in a suicide prevention program and you put a lot of your resources in a period when you're not going to get a lot mm-hmm. of demand for it, and then you're real lean in those peak periods, that's a problem.
You said you had experience working on a suicide helpline. Mm-hmm. Would you say anecdotally that was your experience, that people are more distressed during the holidays?
No.
So it's just, it's another one of those urban lures that have been floating around.
Just one of those things I believed the one that I wanted to just mention, and I wanted to get into this in a little more detail, but we don't have time, is the Pizzagate conspiracy theory. Okay, that Hillary Clinton and her aides and people surrounded by her were running a child pornography ring in a pizza place in Washington, D.C. And that turned out to be, of course, false, but it prompted a young man who was 26 years old, whose name was Edgar Welch, to go and avenge this whole idea and go to the pizza parlor armed with an assault rifle and a handgun, and he fired shots. Didn't hurt anybody, didn't kill anybody, but it was just a huge potential based upon completely fictitious evidence. So,
well, because if you believe something like that to be true, that might be a rational response to something like that.
It might be, but to believe it to the point that you go there armed, mm-hmm. And New York Times did it. It's kind of fascinating. Go to the New York Times article. It was published December 10th, 2016, and just search for the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, and they did a really good job documenting how it all came about. So that's about it.
That's right.
We're there, and
happy year anniversary.
Oh yes!
I hope somebody comes out to help us eat this giant wedding cake.
Yes, and we had great calls. I think we're starting to build a critical thinking community.
That's
and a
right.
community of people who are listening and checking us out, keeping us honest, and adding mm-hmm. value to the show.
Yes, thank you, callers,
and thank you very much, Eric.
Man, don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Red Way Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.